We finished yesterday. We were talking about Baptists on the frontier. We had talked about Daniel Boone and Squire Boone and so forth. And he talked about how Squire Boone, Daniel's brother, that's the end of Roman numeral 2, was an ordained Baptist preacher who founded the First Baptist Church in Kentucky, which is a Boonesboro. And he later founded the First Baptist Church in Indiana, near Squire Boone Caverns. Baptists were very widespread in Kentucky. That's what we'd ended with. So we're looking for Roman numeral 3, Baptist and the War for Independence. Okay. We're ready for Roman numeral 3, Baptist and the War for Independence. May 4, 1776, 2 months before the Declaration of Independence, the colony of Rhode Island officially withdrew from Great Britain and repudiated any allegiance to King George III. The large number of Baptists in this colony, which had been founded by Baptists, led the way in demanding freedom. Their doctrine of soul, S-O-U-L, soul liberty, logically led to the idea of personal freedom from the interference of government. Again, if you're free to respond to the Lord, free to have the Lord work in your life, do you need government to live your life for you? And so there was a natural tension between the Baptist idea of soul liberty, the Baptist idea of separation of church and state, the Baptist idea of sole authority of Scripture. There was a natural tension between that and big controlling government. You see exactly the same thing in the United States today. Who are the people you're most likely to hear complaining about big out-of-control government in the United States today? Not the government itself, Baptists. And that's even much the case yet today. Well, Rhode Island had always been the most free of all the colonies. Rhode Island had no laws restricting religion, no taxation without representation, and no governor appointed by the king. In other words, they elected their own governors. The colonies were divided on that. Some had elected governors, some had appointed governors. Rhode Island had never had an appointed governor. They were always used to electing their leader. Rhode Island was quickly taken by British armies, but a strong local resistance tied down large numbers of British troops till the British government decided that occupying the colony was not worth the trouble, and they moved their forces out. One of my favorite stories of this era is actually before the outbreak of the war, but there is a British anti-smuggling ship that gets caught on a sandbar off the Rhode Island coast on a Sunday. And it's caught on the sandbar, and they're going to have to wait till the next tide to move the ship. So they let all the sailors but two off the ship to go into town. And there's a Baptist church service going on inside of the coast, and they can see the ship. So they see the sailors leave. They take a break in the service. The men go out to the ship, set the two sailors on shore, set fire to the ship, and then come back and finish their service. I mean, that was pretty much the Baptist idea about how they thought about big government. They might let it interrupt a service, but it didn't stop one, and they didn't feel the least bit of embarrassment about that. Well, Baptists were among the first groups to recognize the Continental Congress as legitimate civil government. For this new nation. Several associations of Baptist churches wrote letters of recognition to Congress that usually included an appeal to the Congress. To remember that many of the former colonies did not yet have religious freedom. Not yet have religious freedom. Baptists so completely supported the war for independence. There's only record of one Baptist preacher siding with the British government. 13 colonies, and you only have record of one Baptist preacher that did not take the side of independence. He was a fairly well-known preacher named Morgan Edwards, and he had to leave the colonies for a while, and it was years before he was welcomed back in. Even the Baptists of England supported the American patriots. Dr. Ripon, a well-known Baptist pastor in London, wrote the following to President Manning of Rhode Island College. "I believe all of our Baptist ministers in town, except two, and most of our brethren in the country, were on the side of the Americans in the late dispute. We wept when the thirsty plains drank the blood of our departed heroes, and the shout of a king was among us when your well-fought battles were crowned with victory. To this hour, we believe the independence of America will, for a while, secure the liberty of this country. But if that continent had been reduced, Britain would not have long been free." Again, Baptists were not sympathetic to the idea of unlimited government. They immediately believed in limits to government, like render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but unto God the things that are God's. So they naturally were opposed to unlimited government. Even today in the Ukraine, you know, the current prime minister of the Ukraine, who helped lead driving out the Russian puppet, is a Baptist preacher. And Baptists routinely, because of our natural convictions, believe in limited government. Well, the Baptist desire for religious and personal freedom meant more to the English Baptist. Than the desire to control the American colonies for financial gain. That really was the heart of the issue. Mercantilism was a belief that colonies existed for the good of the mother country. And so the colonies were sort of held slaves to British economic policy. And in England, many people wanted to keep it that way because it benefited England. The Baptists saw something more important than the financial gain of the mother country. Baptists in England saw something more important than financial gain. It's a concept of liberty. Richard Furman, pastor of a Baptist church in Charleston, South Carolina, became a well-known spokesman against the British. There was nothing of the modern concept of preachers supposed to be quiet in their pulpits. I have a book at home that is just sermons preached by preachers supporting the cause of independence and constantly blasting King George III, the English Parliament, England, as being the advocates of unlimited government. Well, Richard Furman in that time was preached, a well-known Baptist preacher preached against the British. He was chased out of Charleston by British agents, and he fled to the American military camp. The famous British general of that region, Lord Cornwallis, who is remembered as having fought and lost the last battle of the War of Independence, Lord Cornwallis is quoted as having said, he feared the prayers of that godly youth more than the armies of Sumter and Marion. And to show you how different a day and age it was, years later when Furman was an elderly preacher, folks remembering the part he played in the War for Independence, had him come preach to Congress. You can't imagine them having a Bible-believing preacher come in and preach to Congress today. But that was not unheard of then, and in his later years, Furman was given the opportunity to preach to Congress. Cornwallis, he offered a large financial bounty to anyone who would kill or capture Furman. Remembering this incident years later, President James Monroe would invite Furman to preach to the Congress and government leaders. Many Baptist preachers served as chaplains in the Patriot Army. chaplains in a Patriot Army. The most famous being John Gano. John Gano, G-A-N-O. Of course, chaplains would be assigned to different units to minister to people spiritually. There were a number of Baptist chaplains. Gano ends up being the chaplain to the headquarters office, including General Washington. Gano had previously been one of two evangelists commissioned by the Philadelphia Association. The other evangelist was Morgan Edwards. Morgan Edwards, the only Baptist leader recorded as opposing the War for Independence. The only Baptist leader recorded as opposing the War for Independence. Gano became a firm friend of George Washington. They said their discussions convinced Washington of believer's baptism. There is a church record that Gano baptized Washington by immersion in front of 42 witnesses. Fairly famous painting of that incident. Some have fussed at that because he never actually left the Anglican Church. He continued to attend the Anglican Church after the war when he was home and so forth. But the indication is not that he left the Anglican Church, but that he personally became convinced of the propriety of believer's baptism and had Gano baptize him. Many Baptist church buildings were devastated by the war, such as Gano's church in New York that was used as a stable by the British cavalry. Stable's not the most clean and respected of places, shall we say. They took his church building, took out the pews, and turned it into a horse stable for officers' horses. Many Baptist church buildings were looted and destroyed. And that is because it was taken, again, for granted by the British. Anytime you had a Baptist church, the people of that church were supporters of the War for Independence. And so was considered the enemy. So when it came to a Baptist church building, they burn it. John Hart, H-A-R-T, John Hart, of Hopewell, New Jersey, was a Baptist and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. So when the men signed the Declaration of Independence, they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. But as you can imagine, all the signers of the Declaration of Independence were targets for the British. Most of them would flee before a British army got to an area. It was a cumbersome process to move an army in those days, and you pretty well had notice an army was coming. But what most of them had to do was leave their houses and, you know, most of their possessions behind. When you're fleeing, you can't take everything with you. Most of them had their houses burnt and their possessions destroyed by the British, and had to live, you know, far away from home in a constant state of being a refugee. And many of these were prominent men, and many of them wealthy men. And when they said they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to this cause, many of them gave up their fortunes in the process, John Hart being one of them. Of course, he had pledged everything to the cause of freedom when he signed the Declaration of Independence. He kept his word even though it cost him everything. George Washington is quoted as saying the Baptists were, throughout America, uniformly and almost unanimously, the firm friends to civil liberty. The firm friends to civil liberty, and the persevering promoters of our glorious revolution. The persevering promoters of our glorious revolution. Without any doubt, the Baptists played a great role in securing independence. Securing independence and establishing liberty in our nation. securing independence and establishing liberty in our nation. You go to the War for Independence, and you can almost break down the sides by denominational religious identification. The exception being the Methodists that were split. The Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists almost always supported the war effort. The Church of England almost always supported the British government. Can you figure out the why on that? Church of England, if you were in the Church of England, who did you acknowledge as the head of the church? The king. So you're not as prone to rebellion against the king, though there's a handful of significant exceptions. George Washington himself was a member of the Church of England. But for the most part, people in the Church of England supported the British cause. For the most part, Baptists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists supported the War for Independence. It was the Methodists who were split. But because of that, the British government targeted Presbyterian churches, Congregational churches, Baptist churches. They targeted preachers. They targeted leaders. And in the course of that, this just drives these people greater and greater wedge against England. In the Civil War, as the North began to occupy areas of the South, we haven't got to it yet, but we will shortly. There's been a great split in the Baptist, Southern Baptist Convention, Northern Baptist Convention. Northern Baptist Convention opposing slavery, Southern Baptist Convention approving of slavery. And most of the churches in the Baptist churches in the South were Southern Baptist Convention. So Union forces, as they took over areas, would sometimes target Baptist churches, assuming they were very active in a pro-slavery cause. In New Orleans, when the Union forces took over, they shut all the Baptist churches down. Well, Baptists in the American Constitution. After the war was over, the most crucial time came for our nation. It was a time of national development. Most revolutions that are fought for freedom end up failing during this period. Just for example, is a pro-freedom movement that overthrows the czars in Russia. But 6 months later, the communists have taken it over, taken advantage of the confusion. You see this over and over again in history. Pro-freedom movements that win rebellions are often destroyed before they can establish a new government. Sometimes the government they end up with is worse than the one they overthrew. And the czars in Russia is an example of that. Well, this was a critical moment, no doubt about it. The attempt to create a constitutional democratic republic. That was the term used during the time, a constitutional democratic republic. Technically, if you looked at that phrase, constitutional democratic republic, word republic means rule of law, constitutional means written rule of law, contract made between the people and the government, and democratic means chosen by the people. So the concept was the people would elect representatives who would make a contract with government, and we would end up with the rule of law. But a rule of law made by people approved by made by leaders approved by the people. Yes. Of course, it's a clash, and our system is designed to force people to work together in order to come up with laws everybody can agree with. We're at a stage in our country right now, we've been in that stage before, where the difference between political parties is so great, you're not finding a way to get that done. In George Washington's era, he consciously split his cabinet between the two sets of political ideas, and people were forced to work together. And Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were vicious opponents of each other. Vicious disagreements. But they are forced to sit down almost every day and work together. And we have lost that in the era in which you have been alive. That has faded dramatically. But in earlier years, I can remember people with greatly different political positions being forced to spend many hours together till they could find a solution both sides could live with. And that was designed on purpose. For several years, the adoption of the Constitution was hotly debated. In the North, the work of the Baptists in Massachusetts is credited with securing the adoption of the Constitution in that state. It was credited with securing the adoption of the Constitution. When a Constitution was first presented, many good patriots opposed it. They didn't like the fact there was no freedom of religion in it, which we could sympathize with, and they feared the government could become too big to control, which we can understand the concerns about. But the other option could be the anarchy that so often destroys. So in Massachusetts, Isaac Bacchus, the great campaigner for religious liberty, campaigned for the Constitution. Isaac Bacchus strenuously campaigned for the Constitution, feeling that it presented the best chance for securing separation of church and state. It didn't do it, the Constitution itself, but he said, we're going to have a better chance getting freedom under this Constitution than we are anything else that's in front of us. In Virginia, the battle over the adoption of the Constitution raged fiercely. Patrick Henry, great patriot, used all of his influence to oppose ratification of the Constitution. Because he did not believe there were enough safeguards for liberty in the document. He didn't think there were enough safeguards for liberty. Thomas Jefferson would call the Constitution the chains of government. The purpose of the Constitution was, we're not going to let the government do this. And Patrick Henry didn't think it went nearly far enough. And he, again, had been a great hero for freedom in terms of the War of Independence, religious freedom, the whole thing. And I understand, reading back, I have two volumes on the debate of the day and reading Patrick Henry's articles. You live in our day and you can really see some things happen that he's afraid would happen. But you also have to answer this. And this is why the people who opposed the Constitution lost. If not the Constitution, what? What was the other option? And they didn't have another option in front of them. Well, Baptists agreed, but they felt it was an important step in the right direction. John Leland of Culpeper County, close friend of Thomas Jefferson, was the prominent spokesman for the Baptists in Virginia. In fact, Jefferson occasionally attended his church and credited Leland for influencing his philosophy of government. The church actually had a monthly business meeting, and Thomas Jefferson went to the business meetings, usually the least exciting part of a church. But he went there to study the way they did business. And he would later say it influenced his political philosophy. They had a written constitution. They had an administrator, not a ruler, but an administrator in the pastor. His authority was not his own, but he made the day-to-day decisions, and the people met for business and took votes. Constitution, votes, leader. And he would say that would influence his philosophy on government and would influence the way the United States was developed. Written constitution, president, not a king, but a president. Legislature elected by the people to vote. Okay. And what that means is he went to some better church business meetings than I have seen over the years. I've seen some church business meetings that got out of control. Not anywhere I pastored, but in places where I was a church member. I've seen some meetings get out of control pretty bad. And he obviously was seeing better church business meetings. Well, Leland led the Baptists of Virginia in supporting James Madison in his fight for the Constitution. You can actually go to Culpeper County in Virginia, and there was a statue put up of Leland at the time. And on the base of the statue, it lists some of his accomplishments. And the battle over ratification in Virginia, the most prominent of the colonies, was too close to call. And Madison went to him and said, if you can get the Baptists to support this, it'll tip the balance. And then he promised that, and Leland said, well, we're concerned there's no religious liberty. Madison promised if the Constitution was adopted, he would then devote himself to adding an amendment that recognized religious liberty. Now, I come from the Will Rogers School of Politics, famous comedian of a few generations past, who said that you can always tell when a politician's lying to you. Lips are moving. He then later went on to say that he never lied while Congress was in session. Because he said an amateur is a bore during the professional season. And a number of other things of that nature. And that's pretty much my understanding of politics. But this time turns out to be different. Okay. Leland led the Baptists of Virginia in supporting James Madison in his fight for the Constitution. The part Baptists played was so important that they were credited with making the difference in that pivotal state. Later, Baptists helped Madison get elected to the House of Representatives. And from that office, Madison campaigned for the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment. In other words, this politician kept his promise. He said, we get the Constitution adopted. I will use the process to fight for an amendment to the Constitution for religious liberty. So Baptists helped him get elected, and he kept his promise. He made his number one priority an amendment that secured religious liberty, which is what is secured in the First Amendment to the Constitution. So for all the many stories I could tell you of politicians not keeping their promises, we're debating in Illinois right now, the governor promised if he got the tax increase 3 years ago, it would only last for 4 years, it would never be made permanent, and now he wants it to be permanent. I knew when he said 4 years ago that it was going to be permanent. But here's a case where a politician kept his promise. So if you were to see, go to Culpeper, Virginia, see the statue of John Leland, and it's listing his accomplishments, it says he got the Constitution adopted in Virginia. And that turned out to be a good move by the Baptists to support that. The First Amendment was demanded by Baptists, was demanded by all Baptists to secure their long-sought religious liberty. Was demanded by all Baptists to secure their long-sought religious liberty. It guarantees, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In other words, to quote Martin Luther King Jr., who I do not often quote, but on this case I will quote approvingly, he said, they created a system where churches were neither the master nor the servant of the state. We're to be left alone. And that was a brilliant way to put it, and that was what was planned. You will have a hard time convincing very many representatives of government today that separation of church and state means that we're supposed to leave each other alone. You have a hard time convincing them of that, and that's a battle that has to be fought all over again. Baptists now had in writing what they had desired for so long, a guarantee of separation of church and state. By that they meant the national government. Baptists now had in writing what they had desired for so long, a guarantee of separation of church and state, a national government. Baptists and religious freedom in Virginia and Massachusetts. The victory was only half won, however, since state governments were still free to make any laws respecting religion that they chose. State governments could make any law, and they still did. After you had the First Amendment, which kept the federal government from bothering you, states could still make their own decisions. This was addressed by the federal government with the passage of the 14th Amendment following the Civil War. That amendment declared the states could not limit rights granted by the federal government. So if the federal government says that you can vote, state cannot tell you you can't. Federal government says you can't interfere with the church, state cannot interfere with the church, so forth. This is the heart of the big battle over gay marriage today. Because what folks really want is a federal ruling on gay marriage, because then every state would be coerced to cooperate with it. Well, such states as Virginia, Massachusetts, and Connecticut still had powerful established churches. This is after the First Amendment, before the 14th, in all those colonies. Virginia, in an attempt to reach a compromise was made. Prominent Virginia politicians, including Patrick Henry, opposed recognizing four religious groups in the state. Where previously only the Church of England was legal, Patrick Henry crafts this compromise that would allow the Episcopal, that's the new name for the Church of England. Can you imagine why they did not use the name Church of England anymore after the War for Independence? They took the name Episcopal. And he said, we'll have four. Instead of one legal group, we'll have four. Episcopal, Presbyterian, Baptist, and Methodist. Episcopal, Presbyterian, Baptist, and Methodist. Each citizen would be allowed to pay a tax to whichever one of those four churches he chose. So you could pick. I'll give mine to the Baptist church. I'll give mine to the Methodist church. I'll give mine to the Episcopal church. This was vigorously supported by the Episcopal and Presbyterian churches. You remember the Presbyterians did not believe in separation of church and state? Early part of the class. While Methodists split over the issue, Baptists, however, fought vehemently against such a proposal. They fought vehemently against such a proposal. Our problem was not that we were not the state church. Our problem was that there was a state church. During the, I was talking yesterday, I believe, about the 5-year battle fought in the state of Florida about licensure of Bible colleges. And at one point during the battle, they came and offered to us to make our college exempt. Just ours. Everybody else would still have a problem, but we could have no problem. I wasn't born yesterday. They were trying to bribe us to drop the effort, just giving us whatever we wanted for ourselves. Hey, matter of fact, at one point, they said, we'll even accredit, make your college accredited, so you can have all the benefits of accreditation. You don't have to fill out an application or anything. In fact, they actually granted us paperwork without our asking that made us accredited. Again, I was not born yesterday. That was a bribe. And they put us on the website as accredited, government, state of Florida website. Our response was, get us off of there. Hey, we're not doing this for us alone. We're doing this over a principle. We don't believe the state should control Bible colleges. And there were a lot of conversations. I get them all sometimes mixed up, but I think it was after they tried to bribe us. I said to one of the Department of Education officials, I said, on the best day of my life, I do not know how to train a bureaucrat. I don't know what bureaucrats need to know. I don't know what classes they need to take. I don't know what information they need to have. But I said, on the best day of your life, you don't know how to train a preacher or a missionary. So we'll make you a deal. I will not tell you how to train bureaucrats. You don't tell us how to train preachers and missionaries, and we can all be happy at the end of the day. And the particular individual I was talking to didn't think that was a very good deal. But I thought it was just a perfect deal. Well, Baptist goals did not include a government-sponsored advantage, but religious liberty. Did not include a government-sponsored advantage, but religious liberty. Thomas Jefferson and John Madison led the struggle for complete religious freedom. In 1785, they succeeded. And the Episcopal Church was no longer upheld and supported by the government. Was no longer upheld and supported by the government. The Episcopal Church soon collapsed as its churches and clergy were no longer supported by tax money. Were no longer supported by tax money. By the way, and you can imagine this, when the tax money was paying all the expenses of the church, what kind of giving did the members of those churches get used to? Not much. I mean, you'd have to worry about whether your pastor's paid or not, whether you have a building or not. The tax payments that people make are used to fund. So what do you think happened when there were no longer any tax payments and no longer any tax dollars coming to the Episcopal Church? their people were not used to providing the money for a pastor's salary. They were not used to keeping up the building with their own expenses. They were not used to doing what the members of every other church had to do. So what happened? Yeah, started to collapse. And you got to a place very quickly where there were very few Episcopal churches in Virginia. Thomas Jefferson became a hated target of those who favored a state church. In his own religious beliefs, Jefferson denied the deity of Christ. He denied the deity of Christ, personal salvation, and the inspiration of Scripture. He denied the deity of Christ, personal salvation, and the inspiration of Scripture. In the minds of some, these beliefs motivated his opposition to the state church, and he was vigorously accused of trying to use the government to promote atheism and infidelity. Atheism and infidelity. Fairly famous episode in Jefferson's life. He took a Bible and he cut out everything involving miracles. Some people think he had this printed and distributed. He didn't. But he took a Bible, he cut out everything that had to do with miracles and made it his own devotional Bible that he had devotions out of every morning. No Jonah and the whale, no creation, no resurrection, no anything supernatural. It's obvious, not a believer. Some people said that's why he opposes the state church, because he's an infidel. But in their attacks against Jefferson, the Episcopal Church ignored the fact he was a member in good standing of one of their own congregations. So how could he believe all that and be a good Episcopal member? If you go back to the beginning of the class and we're comparing religious groups and we're covering the Baptist distinctives, the Episcopal Church does not believe in a regenerated church membership. You didn't have to be saved to be an Episcopal Church member. So he's a member in good standing of the very church that he's trying to de-establish. And they kept saying he's a terrible, horrible person because he's not a Christian, and theologically he was really a mess. But he was a member of their own church. The Presbyterians joined in condemning Jefferson, but he found staunch political allies among the Baptists. Staunch political allies among the Baptists. And a lot of people have thought this was an unusual pairing, and it was, but they supported him for one reason. They didn't agree with any of his theology, but he believed in religious liberty, and they wanted religious liberty. And Jefferson wasn't just saying that, he really believed in it. So he spoke to Baptist associations and received letters of support from Baptist churches. John Leland openly campaigned for Jefferson's election to the presidency. These unlikely allies, and they were unlikely allies. I have a book of sermons of John Leland's. He's as sound as you could get theologically, but he and Jefferson became real political partners because they both believed in religious liberty in spite of what they believed about the gospel. These unlikely allies were bound by a loyalty to individual liberty and the separation of church and state. Individual liberty and the separation of church and state. The battle for religious liberty was to be waged in Massachusetts for a long time, with Isaac Bacchus leading the way. Baptists fought against paying taxes to the state church and against the licensure of preachers. When the state, trying to avoid further conflict, offered to automatically license any ordained Baptist preacher, so we'll just automatically give Baptists a license. Again, the bribe. Bacchus still refused. Bacchus felt he could not accept such a licensure without acknowledging a power in man that should belong to God alone. That should belong to God alone. Same thing would happen in the I want to say the 80s, might have been the 90s, probably was the 90s, state of Kentucky, when they, state licensure, you know, they demanded, what they demanded was that everybody get a license for their profession. Everybody. If you were a cobbler, you had to get a cobbler's license to work on shoes, etc. Every profession. And so when they put in every profession, they put in pastors. And most pastors got the license. And there was a Baptist preacher who refused to take the license. And there was a fee every year to be licensed. And they thought the issue was the fee. So they offered to waive the fee for him. But the issue wasn't the fee. The issue is that the state does not have the authority to license a preacher. That's God's job to commission a preacher, not the state's. And he was in jail for a while, and they finally got that turned around there. But God only knows when we'll have to deal with it next. We have here even in Illinois, you're making hospital visits. When I first came here, I'm a pastor, I'm making hospital visits. Almost every hospital would ask for my clergy ID. And I said, well, who issues clergy ID? And they would say, your denominational office does. I said, you have to have clergy ID to go visit folks. I'm going to get myself in trouble here because it doesn't look like I have my clergy ID on me. Here I do. And they would say, well, the Methodists will give you. You said you have to be licensed by the Methodist or the Presbyterians or somebody to make hospital calls. So I saw an ID, somebody's ID. So I went back, and in the office at Ravenswood Baptist Church, we came up with the Ravenswood Baptist Church clergy ID. Okay? So like I said, they got a Methodist, you got Presbyterian, you've got, you know, congregational. I have the Ravenswood Baptist Church clergy ID that I granted to myself. Okay? But it looks like the others. And since I've had this, and Pastor Engel and Pastor Schneider have them as well, nobody has ever fussed about my ID. I just go in and show them this, and they just want to see that you've been granted an ID by somebody. And so here we are. This is mine that I granted to myself, and everybody's happy. And it's amazing how all that works. But my first few hospital visits here, and most of the hospitals also have their own specific ID. My first few visits, I had people arguing about letting me in because I had no ID issued by an official religious organization. So I solved that and issued my own. And everybody's been happy since then. I just show them to them. Nobody's ever questioned it because I got the card, you know. Well, Baptist spread from... The refusal of Baptists and Quakers to abandon... I'm sorry. The struggle in Massachusetts continued for a long time. Not until 1833 was complete religious liberty permitted there. The refusal of Baptists and Quakers to abandon their religious convictions, and I have to give Quakers credit for fighting the same battle, is credited with finally forcing the state government to change. Their religious convictions is credited with finally forcing the state government to change. I've been mentioning the story yesterday when they tried to shut down the church in Nebraska. And when there were 60 pastors there, they carried them out, got the state police, carried them out, dumped them in the lawn. The next Wednesday night, where there were 1,200 pastors there, they said, we better forget this. It used to be called Christian resistance. It used to be normal. It used to be if a preacher got in trouble, preachers from all over the country would come. And it would just become too much of a pain for people to enforce such ridiculous laws. That isn't always the case today. Most states today have a law against Bible colleges the way that we're used to operating them. Fortunately, in many of those states, the laws are not enforced. To the best of my knowledge, in 2 states, Florida and Michigan, we got those laws overturned, only to have recently the Florida law, the good law, the one that I wrote, overturned. But this is an issue that in many states, they don't try to enforce because there's so many Bible colleges operating in defiance of them. If there was one college operating in defiance, they'd come shut it down. But they'd have to shut people down just all over the place. And so in some states, those laws are not being enforced. In other states, they have a loophole that lets you change your name to get out of it. And the concept of unlimited government or that government has rule over these things is still there, without a doubt. But anyway, Baptists spread from coast to coast. Baptists formed the American Baptist Home Missionary Society for the purpose of starting churches on the frontier. Without a doubt, its most famous representative was John Peck. This guy has an incredible record. John Peck. Without a doubt, its most famous representative was John Peck, a former Congregationalist who'd become convinced of the Baptist distinctives. In 1817, he was appointed a missionary to the area west of the Mississippi. How's that for having a specific defined area? He was a missionary to everything west of the Mississippi. During his first 14 years, he established over 30 churches, helped to build a Bible college in Illinois. And raised the finances for the Indian mission work of Isaac McCoy. And along the way, managed to interview Daniel Boone and write a well-received biography of Daniel Boone. Peck was not known as a great speaker, but he was considered a master organizer. I have known some great pastors and great missions leaders who were not that effective as speakers. They just didn't have that gift. But man, God had his hand on them anyway and did something with them. And it's sometimes an amazing thing to watch. Well, I mean, he was famous for not being a great speaker. When you have that many people saying that about you during your lifetime, that probably holds some weight. But man, was he used of God. After 14 years, his health broke and he was required to take a long rest. He returned to his work, leaving a trail of churches and schools behind him. You can go throughout the West, major city after major city after major city, and the First Baptist Church was started by John Peck. From St. Louis to San Francisco. Yes? He started churches and Christian schools throughout the Western states. Churches and Christian schools. First Baptist Church of Denver. First Baptist Church of Sacramento. You just go on and on and on. He was just considered a master organizer. I've known men who were great preachers who couldn't organize their way out of a paper bag. I've known men who were master organizers who were not great preachers. But God uses different kinds of folks if they're devoted to Him to establish His work. The years before the Civil War were often referred to as the years of Baptist expansion. Years of Baptist expansion. It's starting churches everywhere, all over the place. Indian reservations, little towns, big cities. Many cities, and to some degree the names still stick, there'd be a First Baptist Church, usually in the center of town. Then somebody'd go to the north or the south or whatever, there'd be a Second Baptist Church or a Fourth Baptist Church or so forth. We don't normally use those names, and many of the churches have changed those names, but I've preached at the Eighth Baptist Church in Terre Haute. It still has the name, and you can figure out where it fits into the history of the city and so forth. And the Fourth Baptist Church in Minneapolis became a very prominent church, and that was often the way they were named. Usually downtown, all four sides of the city. Tremendous expansion. We will stop and take our break right here.